In 14 states, Democrats are voting for presidential candidates. A top concern, what are you going to do about immigration at the Mexican border?
What policies are you going to have? Are you going to let all of them in? Hundreds of thousands?
Also today, the coronavirus is hitting South Korea especially hard, but Koreans give their government props for handling it well.
The way they have been dealing with the virus is amazing. They're really organized and transparent.
And we go clubbing in Berlin, where Germans are fighting for their right to party.
It's a safe space for a lot of people. It's a place where people express themselves completely without boundaries.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us. The conditions are cramped and squalid. Refugee camps on the Greek island of Lesbos already house tens of thousands of refugees and asylum seekers, and now thousands more migrants are trying to get in. The Greek government is about to expand the camp, but many Greek residents oppose that, and violence escalated this week. Things came to a head after the Turkish government said it was opening the border with Greece, allowing thousands of migrants to leave Turkey. Anna Benedikson is a humanitarian aid worker who has been on Lesbos since August. She says while most people on the island oppose expanding the refugee camp, the violence against migrants does not reflect the majority.
The majority are rightfully protesting against the development, but can understand that this is not the refugees' fault.
Benedikson says a minority of right-wing protesters are targeting refugees and aid workers. She's on lockdown in her apartment because of the violence outside.
I think we all are in some sort of danger without being alarmistic or dramatic. I mean, we are still being inside. We get reports daily from colleagues and other organizations who have either left the island or evacuated their offices intact. Even if this is a small group, a minority of the local community, it is in much controlling the way we can work right now and move about in the city.
Right. So let's back up and identify where all this started. It was last week that the Greek government started bringing in equipment to expand the refugee camps on Lesbos. I guess they're planning on housing thousands more refugees on the island. What was the response from locals last week?
So it began in a quite different situation last Tuesday, where hundreds of riot police came to Lesbos to transport equipment for new detention centers. And this was met with a lot of protests from local community, protests against the management of the situation, so against the whole building and expanding of refugee camps for their own sake, but also for the refugees.
And then on Thursday, we heard the announcement from Turkey that they were opening the border between Turkey and Greece. How was that information received by locals?
So that's where the turn came, because the first protest, which also became pretty violent, but still was a pretty rightful reaction from the local community and much supported by NGOs and the refugee community. From Thursday night, when the Turkish announcement on the borders opening to Europe, there was another part of the local community that started reacting, more far-right groups.
And how did they react? I mean, what's their attitude toward the refugees?
It's been very hostile, and it's been violence not only against the refugee communities and new arrivals, but also against the humanitarian workers who are here on the island, big and small actors.
Humanitarian workers like you.
Yeah.
You've been to some of these camps. You've seen them. What are they like?
So Moria refugee camp is huge at the moment. It's supposed to house at the absolute maximum 3,000 people. And right now it's 21,000 people in there. The living conditions inside Moria is absolutely horrible. You have 13,000, I think, 15,000 living in summer tents all around Moria, so outside the actual camp called the Olive Grove. So fragile summer tents, which are not at all equipped for permanent living or yet alone winter temperatures and heavy rain. So a lot of extremely vulnerable people living there, people who fled war and violence and survivors of torture, rape. The situation is already, you know, very, very overwhelmingly bad for these people.
So the focus kind of right now is on the border, the Greek and Turkish border. Greece and Turkey, their history is one of perennial conflict and reconciliation. In Lesbos, on Lesbos, are you feeling any of that right now? I mean, are people, are residents there angrier with the Turks, or are they angrier with the refugees?
I would say that the narrative right now, it's portrayed as if the Lesbos community is hostile against refugees as such. But my experience throughout the years that I've spent here since 2018, a couple of months back and forth, is that the Lesbos community has a history of being very friendly against people traveling over this Aegean water, welcoming and tolerant and understanding.
Anna Benedictson, a humanitarian volunteer on the Greek island of Lesbos, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
There is no need to panic about the coronavirus. That's a message we keep hearing from medical professionals, even as the number of cases continues to go up around the world. Just for perspective, though, more people died tragically in the tornado that hit Tennessee last night than from COVID-19 here in the U.S. The number of coronavirus infections is expected to go up here, perhaps substantially. As for fighting the outbreak, the U.S. might take some lessons from South Korea. It now has more than 5,000 confirmed cases, and at least 34 people have died. Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
For millions of South Koreans, emergency cell phone alerts from the government ring out every time a new coronavirus infection is discovered in your area. These bad news alerts are especially frequent in Daegu. The city is about 150 miles south of Seoul, and it's now considered the epicenter of South Korea's COVID-19 epidemic. Choi Bop-jun lives in Daegu with his wife and two kids. I gave him a call to see how things are going. Che, who's 37, says he gets 3 or 4 alerts on his phone every day. They're worrisome, but he says the messages are actually a good sign because they show that the authorities are quickly testing and isolating patients before the virus can spread even more.
안녕하십니까? 질병관리본부 콜센터입니다.
It's not just text messages. The Korea Center for Disease Control runs a coronavirus hotline. It holds televised press briefings, and it offers advice on preventing disease transmission in announcements that run constantly on buses and at subway stations. They're even in multiple languages.
Dear passengers, we would like to offer some useful information to prevent the spread of coronavirus. When taking public transportation, please wear a mask.
Almost everyone you see on the train, bus, or just walking down the street these days is wearing a surgical mask. They're getting harder to find, though. And prices are going way up. So the South Korean government has stepped in to safeguard the supply of masks and stabilize prices. Kim So-young is picking up a 5-pack of respiratory masks at a sale in Seoul. It's sponsored by a publicly owned company. That takes the price down to about $5. Kim says she waited in line for almost an hour because she couldn't find masks anywhere else. Until now, she says she was wrapping a scarf across her nose and mouth as a substitute. South Korea's government has not gone as far as China in locking down entire cities. Instead, it's telling citizens to limit contact with other people. Many Korean companies are letting their employees work from home. Schools and universities have extended their winter vacations, and countless public events have been canceled. The K-pop boy band BTS has called off its spring tour. So far, medical professionals are giving the government high marks for its response to the coronavirus outbreak. Dr. Kim Arum is an infectious disease specialist at Inha University Hospital in Incheon.
The way they have been dealing with the virus is amazing. They're really organized and transparent and vision as well.
But Kim says she's not sure that the U.S. is capable of being as efficient in its response to the disease.
We approved the diagnostic kit within a few days, so we could diagnose a lot, like more than 3,000 patients a day. I don't know if the United States can do that. And also in Korea, our national health insurance system is good, so we go to hospital without any hesitation, anytime.
Kim says Americans should probably get used to wearing masks in public, just like Koreans are doing. She says she wears one to protect her patients.
So protecting others from myself,
I feel there's a bit of social pressure to wear a mask.
Yeah, but it shows like how thoughtful, how considerate you are about others.
She points out that I wasn't wearing a mask when I showed up, then gives me a pack to take home. Kim adds that as coronavirus infections rise in both South Korea and the U.S., authorities need to pay attention to those most vulnerable. That means the elderly, people with chronic health problems, and those with disabilities. That's a big concern for Gwon Song-gu. He manages a residential facility in Seoul for 30 patients who require full-time care. Gwon agrees to speak with me, but only through a cracked open sliding glass door. He says the disease could spread fast here because everybody lives in such close proximity. His patients have mental disabilities. They can't walk on their own, and many have tuberculosis. Gwon and the other staff have not left the center since January, he says. They don't want to risk coming into contact with anyone on the outside who might be infected with the coronavirus. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
There is some good public health news. Today, a burst of joy outside an Ebola treatment center in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Health workers in the city of Beni discharged the last Ebola patient being treated in the entire country. They walked her out of the clinic dancing and singing, using medical boxes as drums and shakers. Since the Ebola outbreak in the DRC began a year and a half ago, more than 3,000 people have been infected and more than 2,000 people have died. It's been designated a global health emergency. But the World Health Organization now reports that the country has gone 2 straight weeks with no new cases. Another good reason to rejoice. They are celebrating with caution, though. To be officially Ebola-free, the country must go 42 days without having an active case. Dozens of people are still being monitored who came into contact with that last patient. And responders say it's critical to remain vigilant. You know who loves iTunes? North Korea. Let me explain. Economic sanctions on North Korea make it basically impossible for Pyongyang to bring in any foreign currency. So how does Pyongyang get its hands on cash? One way, cyber attacks, hacking into financial systems and stealing money. We've known for a while now that cryptocurrency exchanges are a key target for North Koreans. You know, the online marketplaces where people can trade Bitcoin and other digital currencies. Now, an indictment unsealed in Washington yesterday is giving us more details about that. Priscilla Moriuchi is with the cyber threat intelligence consultancy Recorded Future.
Before this, you know, we had to sort of estimate the value of these operations for North Korea. And now we have an actual number on one operation. Right, which is pretty staggering.
She says the indictment details one operation from 2018.
In which $250 million worth of cryptocurrencies were stolen. That amount is massive, right, for North Korea, and is only one operation.
The North Koreans didn't do it alone. 2 Chinese hackers helped them steal the money and to launder some of it through iTunes gift cards. Gift cards they could then use to get even more Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
It's just another example of how practical North Korean hackers actually can be.
Yeah, she wasn't too surprised about money laundering through gift cards. But Moriuchi says the indictment does provide new information about Pyongyang's cyber tactics. And can I just say, we also now know a lot more about who's still using iTunes gift cards. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Super Tuesday's votes are still being counted here in the U.S., but in Israel, it appears that the incumbent is on course to be the winner. Supporters of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party are celebrating. They won the most seats in Israel's parliament. But what comes next? That is not entirely clear. The World's Ariel Osaran is just back from reporting in Israel.
In Israeli politics, a victory means one thing, and that's forming a government. That's something that didn't happen in the last 2 elections, in April and in September, and we're not quite there yet this time around. If the vote tally is accurate, Netanyahu definitely produced an impressive achievement for himself and for the right-wing religious bloc. But you can't call this yet a victory because Netanyahu is still short of a majority. He needs 61 seats out of 120, and currently he's too short of that number.
On top of all of this, there are Netanyahu's legal troubles. He's got a trial coming up on corruption charges. That's supposed to start in exactly 2 weeks. Did that not bother the 1 in 3 Israelis who voted for him?
So I raised that exact same question to Yochanan Plesner. He's the head of the Israeli Democracy Institute.
To some extent, rather than election fatigue, we did experience indictment fatigue.
Plesner says that the Israelis voted in huge numbers, and while Netanyahu's legal issues strongly influenced voters in September, they were less of an issue this time around. Israelis are simply sick of the current political stalemate, and it seems like they were just looking for a way to move on and get a government in place.
So Netanyahu's party, the Likud, did get more seats than the last election in September. What did he do different this time around?
So Netanyahu's main rival is Benny Gantz. He's the head of the Blue and White Party. And back in September, he ran on the promise to build a secular unity government with Netanyahu's party, but without Netanyahu. That was very popular with voters, but it just didn't work. So this time around, the two main options on voters' minds were, one, a Benny Gantz-led government with the support of the Arab political parties, or a Netanyahu-led government with his ultra-Orthodox partners. And yesterday, more Israeli voters chose the latter. Here's Yochanan Plesner again.
Clearly, Netanyahu ran a more effective campaign. Very few inhibitions. He really attacked Gantz and his personality in a way that created some doubt among certain voters about Mr. Gantz's competence and fit for the top job in Israel.
And there was another thing that happened late in the race, Marco, and Plesner calls it a James Comey event, quote-unquote, similar to the 2016 U.S. election. Israel's state prosecutor announced he would investigate a cyber company chaired by Benny Gantz for possible fraud, and that probably lost him some votes.
So, Ariel, now what?
Well, the final results should come out in the next day or so, and Netanyahu will probably have the first chance to put together a government. That means weeks of secret negotiations and political horse trading. What to watch for is whether the prime minister's Likud party can find one or two defectors from rival parties to join them and reach the majority of 61 seats. And if things drag out long enough, it may be time for a fourth election later this year.
Yeah. Unprecedented to the unprecedented. The world's Ariel Osaran. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Mass demonstrations, sit-ins, and blockades have spread across Canada. Canadians from all walks of life are showing their support for an Indigenous nation in British Columbia. The leaders of the Wet'suwet'en Nation say they were never consulted about a natural gas pipeline that cuts across their traditional land. The $6 billion pipeline would deliver natural gas westward, some 400 miles to the Pacific coast. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been criticized for his remarks on the issue.
Every attempt at dialogue has been made, but discussions have not been productive. We can't have dialogue when only one party is coming to the table.
The hereditary chiefs did sit down with government officials this last week, and after 3 days of intense negotiations, a tentative resolution has been reached. Angela Sterrett has been following the standoff closely for the CBC in Vancouver.
I think what we're seeing on the ground with the blockades and the protests and people blocking, you know, railways, intersections, I think all of those individuals and groups have been very focused on what's happening in Wet'suwet'en territory. And, you know, you're hearing people standing up for hereditary chiefs and for quote unquote land defenders. But I think what we're hearing across Canada is a lot of non-Indigenous people really learning about what it means to be an Indigenous person. I've reported on a lot of people who have this really new interest or appetite to learn about Indigenous history, to learn about Indigenous traditional government. And you see that on the Indigenous side as well. People really saying, let's focus on our hereditary systems, our traditional governments, and try to return back to what was.
During the weeks of protests, Angela, police in Canada have been criticized for how they've treated activists in some cases. What's happened? Have a lot of people been arrested?
There were, I believe, 14 Kitsan people and their supporters arrested during one of their rail blockades. There have been a number of people in the city. I don't have the exact numbers on hand, but a lot of people definitely being arrested over this. I think one of the things that's been interesting as well, I'm Indigenous, I'm Kitsan. On all my social media feeds, it's all Indigenous people talking about the racism they've experienced, like people being physically attacked. These have been elders at protests. I interviewed an Indigenous woman who looks Indigenous, who was with her 14-year-old son, who was attacked in her car. Talked to one woman, 600 messages she got telling her to go drink Lysol, to go stand on a corner, to go extinct. So it's a brutal time for Indigenous people right now.
Well, what can you tell us about this tentative resolution reached by the hereditary chiefs and government officials?
So I think right off the bat, it's important to note that this didn't have any bearing on the construction of the pipeline. We heard from Coastal GasLink, that's the natural gas company, that they are not stopping construction. What we've been hearing is that there was a tentative accord or agreement that did have to do with rights and title of the Wet'suwet'en people.
Have you seen the full text of the agreement yet?
No, nobody has seen that agreement as of yet, and we're not sure if we ever will. At this point, all that we know is that the Coastal GasLink is continuing construction and that the accord has to do with land rights and title of Wet'suwet'en territory. I think the main thing is that this agreement has not been ratified. That's an important note to make. It will need to go back to the entire Wet'suwet'en community to be ratified. So this means elected leaders, community members, hereditary chiefs all together, and that should take up to 2 weeks.
As for this tentative agreement, I mean, it sounds like it doesn't really settle the issue of the pipeline. What's it going to do to the energy of protesters?
What you were hearing from the protesters from day one was that they were in support of Wet'suwet'en hereditary leaders defending their land. I think as of Monday, so yesterday, on the ground, it's a lot quieter. There hasn't been any disruptions that I'm aware of today. It does seem like things have cooled down a bit until people are ready to take that direction from hereditary leaders. But I mean, keep in mind, we still don't know what that agreement says. We haven't heard yet from the people on the front lines in the way of, you know, we're going to continue to protest despite these agreements made. But you never know. There could be a huge turn in the next couple of weeks as we wait to hear what the Wet'suwet'en community members decide upon in terms of this agreement with the provincial and federal governments.
The CBC's Angela Starrett in Vancouver. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're with the world. Presidential campaigns are trying everything to connect with Latino voters, even a kids' mariachi band.
And when you invite the youth to play, the students to play, their parents come to see them give a performance, and all of a sudden you have their parents at a political event.
I'm Marco Werman. Tuesday has never been so super. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Super Tuesday, make or break day for the Democratic presidential candidates. It's the moderates led by Mike Bloomberg and Joe Biden.
Look, folks, this time we got to bring around everybody. Democrats, Republicans, independents of every stripe.
Versus the progressive wing of the party led by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders.
There is a massive effort trying to stop Bernie Sanders. That's not a secret to anybody in this room. The corporate establishment is coming together. The political establishment is coming together, and they will do everything. They are really getting nervous that working people are standing up.
Today, though, for the candidates, is a day to shake hands, slap some backs, not a day to probe the issues deeply. But for many voters concerned about where the candidates stand on immigration policies, they're still waiting on specifics from most of the candidates. Here's The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell.
The other night, at a campaign event in San Francisco for Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren, a champion for immigrant rights took the mic in front of a young, diverse crowd.
Vice President Julian Castro.
He's stumping for Senator Elizabeth Warren. And the joke is, if she gets the nomination, he'll be her number two. One big reason people are so enthusiastic for the former presidential candidate, especially in California, is how big he went on immigration. He was the first with a plan and the first to propose decriminalizing certain migrants crossing into the U.S. in the debates.
The only way that we're going to guarantee that these kinds of family separations don't happen in the future is that we need to repeal this law. There's still going to be consequences if somebody crosses the border. It's a civil action. Also, we have
he took heat for that. Some critics tagged him the open borders candidate. Since Castro's left the race, immigration has also gone into the shadows, at least on the big stage. I asked him why.
Well, look, it's unfortunate that the debate moderators have chosen not to ask questions about immigration lately the way that they did in the beginning.
The moderators have a role, sure, but the current candidates are largely sticking to similar talking points, saying they'll start reversing on day one what the Trump administration has done. It's a long to-do list, stopping the travel ban, accepting more refugees, and restoring DACA, the Obama-era program that grants work permits to undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as kids.
On day one, we will restore the legal status of the 1.8 million young people and their parents who are eligible.
Why do we have a crisis at the border? In no small part because we have withdrawn help from people in Central America who are suffering.
What Donald Trump has done of ripping kids away from their parents is a disgrace.
Here's what I'm going to do as president. I'm going to make sure that we end every executive order this president, Trump, has instituted.
That was Democratic presidential candidates Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Mike Bloomberg, and Joe Biden. For people who've been working on immigration for years, they also want to hear what a Democratic president would do on day two, beyond reversing Trump's policies.
This is a very defining election because our lives and the lives of our community are at stake.
Christina Jimenez co-founded United We Dream, a large immigrant rights group. She came to New York City undocumented when she was 13 from Ecuador.
It's been disappointing to see that the conversation around immigration has not even been a key part of many of the debates that we've had during the primary seasons.
She wants to hear what exactly the candidates mean when they say things like comprehensive immigration reform.
Comprehensive immigration reform means more enforcement, more punishment, and more criminalization for immigrant communities in exchange of a pathway to citizenship.
The topic may get harder to avoid once it's Trump versus a single Democrat, and if that candidate must get detailed about their plans. Muzaffar Chishti, with the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute, also wonders what if there's an increase of migrants at the border?
What policies are you going to have? Are you going to let all of them in? Hundreds of thousands? If they start taking positions on what they will actually do, then they have to make hard choices.
The Democratic candidates do have plans and support policies that once seemed polarizing. Here's a moment from a presidential debate last summer.
Raise your hand if your government plan would provide coverage for undocumented immigrants.
All the candidates' hands went up, but polls show divisions on that issue. Candidates also proposed temporarily freezing deportations, and they're flip-flopping about that. It could all give Trump an opening to label the Democrats as pro-open borders, even if they're not. And while immigrant rights activist Christina Jimenez has been disappointed in how little the Democrats have spoken about immigration, she says they're better than the alternative.
Because what you see is a completely different rhetoric than what Trump is laying out with all the Democratic candidates, including those who are moderates, being very clear that they are not in alignment with the policies of the Trump administration with regards to immigrants.
If the Democratic candidates really step up, Jimenez says, it'll be because of movements led by immigrants, the people, families, and voters pushing for change. For The World, Monica Campbell.
Okay, let's set aside the candidates and focus now on voters, young Latino voters. Our project Every 30 Seconds examines that crucial slice of the electorate. Three reporters from the project are now with me. They just happen to be from states that have a ton of delegates on the line today. Stella Chavez from KERA in Dallas, Texas, Naomi Prilo from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Max Rivlin-Adler from KPBS in San Diego.
Hi.
Hello, Marco.
Hi, Marco.
It is great to have you all here. As I said, you're tracking the young Latino vote with our Every 30 Seconds project. Every 30 seconds, a young Latino turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. So I'd like to know what each of you have been seeing in your states leading up to Super Tuesday. Were presidential candidates intentionally seeking young Latino voters? And let me start with you, Stella, in Dallas.
Some candidates definitely were. We saw the Sanders campaign mobilizing a lot of young Latinos in Texas. He's had huge turnouts at his rallies, but he's also getting the attention of older Latinos. And he's not the only one. We're also seeing a ton of ads on TV and social media from Bloomberg.
Juntos vamos a reconstruir la nación. Soy Mike Bloomberg y apruebo este mensaje.
We've even seen a lot of Bloomberg ads on Spanish language television.
And in California, Max Rivlin-Nadler, is that Latino voter outreach is similar to Texas?
Yeah, it's a pretty similar style. Bernie has definitely paid attention to the youth vote, but he's not solely focused on that. He's also looking at their parents. So this is a really great example of what the Sanders campaign has been doing in California, which is at a rally at San Ysidro High School back in December. This San Ysidro High School is just around maybe 10 miles from the border. He had the mariachi band from the school itself, so a bunch of high schoolers play. And when you invite the youth to play, the students to play, their parents come to see them give a performance, and all of a sudden you have their parents at a political event as well.
Naomi Prilo in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, what have you been seeing?
You know, it's actually the opposite of what's been going on in California and Texas. When candidates come over to North Carolina and, you know, the Carolinas in general and in the South, they're more focused on the black vote. It's like they compartmentalize. They think California, Texas definitely need to push for the Latino vote. But then when they come here, it's more focused on the black vote because there is so much history here and they don't focus on Latinos at all. You know, we have a lot of Latinos in Charlotte, but then we also have a lot of them in rural communities. I spoke to Brian Guevara, who is a student at Guilford Technical Community College in Greensboro, and he's Afro-Latino, and he's from Honduras, and he's voting for the first time in this election. And so we had a conversation about what he was thinking about.
I have listened to Trump. Some of the things that he's saying, he's politically right. As in, you have to respect it, but some things aren't logical. So right now, I am leaning towards Bernie.
And it's interesting because he told me that he also feels that he's being catered to on one half because he's black and these candidates are really pushing the black vote. But then on the other half, he feels like he's not being heard because he's Latino. It's an interesting dynamic that we have going on here.
So Texas and California have the most number of delegates for Super Tuesday. The number of young Latino voters also happens to be growing in those two states. Stella Chavez in Dallas, are you seeing any other noteworthy activity?
Well, what is interesting is that, you know, historically, Texas has been seen as a largely conservative state, but that's been changing more recently because so many people are moving from other places, especially from Democratic-leaning states. Also, Texas Latinos tend to be more conservative than Latinos in other states. And I think that the polls that we've seen, while we can't always rely on the polls, we've noticed that Bernie still remains ahead of the other candidates, especially like Biden and Bloomberg. I think that more and more people, especially these candidates, are paying attention to Texas Latinos, perhaps more so than they were in the past.
And Max, in San Diego, this year, California moved up its primary to Super Tuesday. Who is that going to help today, both in terms of voters and in terms of candidates?
Last election in 2016, the Associated Press actually called the election for Clinton on the right before the California primary, which spurred California to move up its primary so it would have much more of a say in who is going to be the Democratic nominee. And that's really motivated a lot of kind of activist base to try to get involved here. So the thing about California, especially as we begin to shape narratives about what happened today, is that it's going to take weeks for California to get a final delegate count and a final count of the votes. If we remember in 2018, you know, what looked like kind of a smaller blue wave of Democrats winning became a much larger one because California, it took several weeks to get all of the ballots in because it accepts same-day registration. It does mail-in ballots. It takes a while to get the final count. So California might be a huge factor in, you know, who racks up which delegates, but it might take a long time to figure out exactly who those delegates will go to and how big of a role California played.
Well, obviously, we won't know all of the outcomes until later tonight and beyond, apparently. But clearly, what we've been hearing from you is that there's definitely a big influence from Latino voters, especially young Latinos in very different parts of the country. Naomi Prilo, Max Rivlin-Nadler, and Stella Chavez, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Thank you, Marco.
Big legal news out of Colombia today, news that sets back the pro-choice agenda. One of Colombia's highest courts says a restrictive abortion law can stand. It's one of two cases in South America that signal where the future of women's access to abortions is heading. Here's the world's Jorge Valencia.
This morning, just hours after Colombia's Constitutional Court issued its decision, two opposing members of Congress went on a popular radio program.
Julio, muy buenos días. Un saludo a toda la audiencia.
Juanita Goibertus is a representative with the Green Alliance Party.
Buenos días, Lucas. Muy especial para ti, para...
And John Milton Rodriguez is a senator with the Free and Just Colombia Party. Each one of them gave their own reaction to the court's decision. Goibertus saying women should have broader access to abortion, and Rodriguez saying it should be restricted. Ultimately, the court is allowing the procedure only when medically necessary. The conversation was civil for the most part, but then...
No, no, no. Una cosa es despenalizar tres causales. Una cosa es despenalizar tres causales.
They argued over whether the court says abortion is a right for women in Colombia.
Perdóname, déjame, yo te explico.
When you talk about abortion, it becomes very heated, very fast.
Dr. Maria Vivas is a physician who directs Fundación Orientame in Bogotá. Her organization provides reproductive health services, including abortions.
If you pay attention to the arguments to decriminalize, to totally decriminalize abortion, they're robust public health-based arguments.
These arguments focus on the fact that illegal abortions can be fatal. Some 400,000 abortions are performed in Colombia every year, according to the U.S.-based Guttmacher Institute. And it's estimated that only a fraction of them are done legally. Only a handful of countries in Latin America have legislation allowing abortions. So advocates across the continent have had their eyes set on Colombia and also Argentina. Thousands of people recently gathered in Buenos Aires in front of the Argentine National Congress. Thousands of women held up green bandanas, a symbol of the struggle for women's rights, says Victoria Freire. She runs an organization that advocates for women's rights in Buenos Aires. This week, Argentina's new president, Alberto Fernandez, says he will send a bill to Congress to legalize abortion. Freire says the pending legislation is the result of a long-standing feminist movement that is now receiving more support from politicians. She says this movement is international. It's like Me Too in the United States, Freire says, or like protests against feminicide in Mexico. She says that for her, feminism is transforming life across the continent. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
U.S. anti-abortion groups are trying to influence Colombia's abortion debate. We have that story at theworld.org. In Rome, the streets are noticeably emptier this week thanks to coronavirus, even though the outbreak in Italy is centered 300 miles to the north of the capital. Pamela Harris is an American who teaches law at John Cabot University in Rome. Many of her American students, they up and left Rome for the States.
It's unfortunate that when the outbreak in Italy is reported on in the U.S., you just see this map of Italy as if it were one entity for the sake of this disease. And it's really not the case. So in Rome, people are not sick, and we don't feel an imminent threat of that.
I was just looking at some photographs of Venice and Piazza San Marco completely empty. Has Rome's tourism business been affected? What's that like in Rome?
I mean, it's much slower and quieter than usual. And, you know, you can feel that locals are staying home, and actually probably a great time to come visit. But
well, I was going to ask you, I mean,
not at the risk of getting stuck.
Right. I mean, if everything's open, though, in Rome, and you say it's business as usual, what do you make of foreigners' reactions to avoid traveling to Italy?
From our vantage point, it feels quite overblown. But it's understandable given the way that things are reported. So if you look at the Center for Disease Control report, all of Italy is a level 3 risk and all of Italy is dangerous place to travel. But that really is misleading when you consider how big Italy is and how controlled and contained the disease seems to be.
Right. And a level 3 travel warning from the CDC indicates avoiding all non-essential travel.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense from, you know, Milan and Veneto, but it doesn't really make sense for central Italy.
When you saw that warning level of 3, did that worry you there in Rome?
Well, yeah, it did, because at that point we knew that our American partners were probably going to feel like the tipping point had been reached and like it was the responsible thing for them to call their students back home, because we're all navigating in a great uncertainty.
Are you thinking like right now about the possibility that you might have to self-quarantine?
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly not excluding that might happen. And, you know, Rome becomes like Milan and the university has to shut its door to students. That doesn't mean that the university shuts its door. So if universities are closed down, professors are still going to come to work. We're still going to hold office hours online. We're still going to be in touch with our students. We'll put our lectures online if we have to.
Pamela Harris, a law professor at John Cabot University in Rome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Clubbing in Berlin. It's been a thing for a long time. The musical Cabaret showed life at the seedy Kit Kat Club as the Nazis were rising to power. Fast forward to the 1980s.
Now's the time on Sprocket for me, dog!
SNL and Mike Myers spoofed disaffected young Germans who also like to dance. Today, Berlin's club scene is under threat from rising property values in a gentrifying city. But one group of clubbers wants to save the scene with a law that would give nightclubs the same status as opera houses. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Daniel Plotch fell in love with techno music as a teenager in the 90s. He says he used to hang out at the legendary club Tresor, which was in the cellar of an old department store where the bank vault used to be. The dance floor was sandwiched between bank safes.
I just went down in there like I got goosebumps. I couldn't believe myself. Like it was kind of like an enlightenment, just, you know, in this like old bank vault and then this like ramming bass and kick drum and the hi-hat. And you're just like, you know, you're losing it.
Daniel wanted to bring this religious experience to others. It was only a matter of time before he ditched his law career and opened up Stadtbad in Wedding, a techno club in an abandoned city pool. He says the top electronic musicians in the world played there.
Nina Kravitz, Ben Klock, Len Farke, Sven Feit. Yeah, just name it. People would actually come from all over Europe just to see a certain lineup. They would write us in advance to be like, oh, we're coming for this night. Can we somehow make sure that we get in? And then you just kind of saw what impact this actually has.
But then in 2015, the Stadtbad Club became a casualty of gentrification. The owner of the property decided to sell to a private developer for a huge profit. Stadtbad is now rental apartments. This is happening all over the city. And in fact, there's even a word for it, Clubsterben, which translates as club death. About 100 clubs have closed in Berlin over the past decade, and about 25 more are under threat. And now club owners and supporters are coming together to do something about it. They're advocating for a change in the German building law that would give clubs the same status as opera houses and theaters. Right now, clubs are in the same urban planning category as brothels and casinos. Lutz Leixenring is the spokesperson for the Club Commission, an industry lobby group.
In a club, you're curating your program, you're booking artists, you're going to festivals. So that's much closer to how a theater, for instance, or a concert hall is run.
If the law were changed, it would be a lot easier for new clubs to get zoning licenses.
and it would pave the way for more clubs to open, even in residential neighborhoods. Now, if this were happening in New York, where I'm from, I almost guarantee you there would be a large outcry from neighbors. I mean, who wants to live across from a nightclub? It's loud, there are long lines, lots of drug use. But in Berlin, this proposal has widespread support, both from the public and from politicians.
Natürlich bräuchte man eigentlich sowas wie ein Gewerbemietenregelung.
For example, this is Klaus Leder. He's in Berlin government on the Culture Committee, and he's basically arguing that clubs need more protections. It could be that politicians are jumping on the bandwagon because clubs bring millions of euros to the local economy. The Club Commission estimates that 3 million tourists come to Berlin every year for the clubs. But Lutz Lexering says there's more to it than that.
It's part of the DNA of Berlin that you have this kind of club scene and people talk about it and come from all over the world. Even the startup scene is like advertising with come to Berlin to this vibrant culture. And it's just, it's just defined by it.
And maybe that's why techno fiends and politicians have united under the hashtag Save Our Spaces. Berliners know that giving nightclubs the same status as opera houses won't change everything, like it won't reverse gentrification. But they hope it could lead to a nightclub revival. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You all can keep on dancing, but that's where we've got to end the party. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.